Today is October 5th, with only 29 days left until the presidential election. COVID-19 has both candidates getting creative with their campaign events. President Trump is keeping his supporters updated via Twitter on his COVID-19 treatment at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, while former Vice President Joe Biden is on the campaign trail in Florida. And the Supreme Court begins a new term today, one justice short after the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. These stories and more on Washington Today. I'm your host, Nkoyo Iyamba. We begin with an update on President Trump's medical condition after being treated for COVID-19.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here. Over the past 24 hours, the president has continued to improve. He's met or exceeded all standard hospital discharge criteria. He'll receive another dose of remdesivir here today, and then we plan to get him home. It's been more than 72 hours since his last fever. Oxygen levels, including ambulatory saturations and his work of breathing, are all normal. Though he may not entirely be out of the woods yet, the team and I agree that all our evaluations, and most importantly, his clinical status, support the president's safe return home, where he'll be surrounded by world-class medical care 24/7.
That was the president's physician speaking late this afternoon outside Walter Reed Medical Center. Reporters also asked Dr. Conley a series of questions, including questions about President Trump's drive-by of supporters yesterday afternoon. Here's that exchange.
And how was it safe for him to drive around in a cloth mask yesterday? And how is it safe for him now to return to the White House where there have been so many cases? How's any of this safe?
So the president has been surrounded by medical and security staff for days, wearing full PPE. And yesterday, the U.S. Secret Service agents were in that same level of PPE for a very short period of time. We've worked with our infectious disease experts to make some recommendations for how to keep everything safe down at the White House for the president and those around him. We're looking at where he's going to be able to carry out his duties. Office space, and I'll just say that it's in line with everything we've been doing upstairs for the last several days.
Can you tell us, please, on testing, can you tell us when he had his last negative test? Was it Thursday? Was it Wednesday? When do you remember when he had his last negative test?
I don't want to go backwards.
For people who are around him to know.
I understand. The contact tracing, as I understand it, is being done. I'm not involved with that. So.
Why did you begin this conversation? Let you leave, or was this something he pushed for?
No. So we try to get patients home and out of the hospital as quickly as is safe and reasonable. Every day a patient stays in the hospital unnecessarily is a risk to themselves. And right now there's nothing that's being done upstairs here that we can't safely conduct down home.
You said that 7 to 10 days was a window that you'd be concerned about. I don't think we're there yet. So do you have concerns about potential worsening or reversal? And what are your plans for addressing that if it were to happen?
You're absolutely right. And that's why we all remain cautiously optimistic and on guard because we're in a bit of uncharted territory when it comes to a patient that received the therapies he has so early in the course. So we're looking to this weekend. If we can get through to Monday with him remaining the same or improving, better yet, then we will all take that final deep sigh of relief. But as I said, 24/7 world-class medical care surrounding him down there. We're not going to miss anything that we would have caught up here.
Dr. Sean Conley, President Trump's physician, late this afternoon at Walter Reed. You can find the entire briefing on our website at cspan.org. So far, the U.S. is at 7.45 million COVID cases, and 210,000 people have died from complications associated with the virus. Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, was on CNN today. He was answering questions about the pandemic and the new number of cases diagnosed each day. He said, quote, "I am certainly not pleased or satisfied, but I'm actually disturbed and concerned about the fact that our baseline of infections is still stuck at around 40,000 per day." Fauci told CNN, "That's no place, quote, to be when you're trying to get your arms around an epidemic and get it to a very low baseline, end quote. Dr. Fauci was also asked about his role in the president's care for COVID-19. Here's that exchange.
Well, I think it's obvious, John, that I have not been involved. But again, you know, I don't want to get into talking about the president's case because that's not something that I've really been cleared to talk about. But personally, I have not been involved in the direct care of the president. I might comment that my colleagues that I know, including Sean Connolly, are very good physicians, and they're very qualified. So I am really confident that the president of the United States is getting the optimal care that you can get with the team over at Walter Reed.
You say you don't want to comment on his case specifically. Let's talk about, though, I think, some of the issues that have arisen, which is that we talked to a New York Times reporter, Michael Shear, who was at the White House event more than a week ago where Amy Coney Barrett was officially nominated for the Supreme Court. There were a lot of people there. There was an indoor portion of that. He stopped by the White House that day and then traveled with the president that night. He is now tested positive, says he hasn't been called for contact tracing. Should he be contacted? What does that tell you about the contact tracing from that potentially dangerous event?
You know, John, I don't know what the process of the contact tracing is that's going on at the White House. In general, the CDC is very much involved with the local authorities. So I don't think it would be appropriate for me to comment about the contact tracing that's gone on around the White House because I'm not informed on it. But the one thing we do know is that when you get cases, if you have a situation where someone comes into contact and is infected, and you know that there are people around him, that the important public health measure is to do the identification, isolation, and contact tracing so that you can get people who have been exposed to go into the appropriate quarantine, get tested, and do the things that are very clearly delineated in the CDC guidelines.
Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today on CNN. Campaign 2020 here on C-SPAN Radio. Wednesday's vice presidential debate is moving ahead as scheduled. Democratic vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris arrived in Salt Lake City over the weekend. That's the site of the debate. She toured This Is the Place Heritage Park with State Senator Scott Howell on Saturday morning. Here's a portion of her remarks.
Look at that. I mean, it's when you think about the spirit of America, including the pioneering spirit, right? And that is so much a part of the fabric of who we are as a nation. Brigham Young, I mean, they were essentially immigrants. They were fleeing persecution. They were fighting for religious freedom. Part of the spirit was shoulder to the wheel, which is really about everything that I think we're talking about right now in America. Let's put our shoulders to the wheel. Let's do the work that is necessary to continue to fight for our ideals and our values, and in this case, what they fought for so many years ago, which is for freedom and to hold our country accountable for the ideals we say we hold dear. So it's great to be here. I'm really honored to be here. I'll be here for the next few days preparing for the debate, and I want to thank the people of Utah for being so welcoming in such a warm way. So thank you all. Thank you.
That was Vice Presidential candidate Senator Kamala Harris from Saturday morning. Vice President Mike Pence is headed to Salt Lake City Monday evening. Doug Wilkes is the editor of the Deseret News in Salt Lake City, Utah. We're discussing his article, Inside the Newsroom, what it took to bring the vice presidential debate to Salt Lake City. Doug, before we talk about what it took for Utah to host the 2020 vice presidential debate, Senator Kamala Harris was in Utah over the weekend. She's doing a bit of surveying, if you will. What's the word on her experience visiting Utah?
You know, it's been very, very interesting. She was here. She wanted to do two things. One, acclimate, since we're at elevation here. She wanted to learn a little more about Utah, and she wanted to learn about the pioneer heritage and culture. And she spoke directly to the people of Utah in a very interesting way, which is, she says, the effort to, quote, put your shoulder to the wheel, which resonates with a pioneer culture, to work hard in industry is what's needed in the nation right now. So it's one of the benefits to having the debate in Utah is she gets to know us and we get to know her. So it's she's off to a good start.
And so what did it take to bring the vice presidential debate to Salt Lake City? I understand that it was a simple idea about 6 years ago from the Utah Debate Commission and has now culminated into a national vice presidential debate.
Right. So what happened was we were concerned some professors, others, civic-minded individuals were concerned about low voter turnouts in Utah. And for a people that prides itself on really being involved in volunteerism, they wanted to do something to promote the civic-mindedness of the electorate. So the debate commission locally was formed, and it's one of only three in states across the country to put candidates before voters. Utah had been a predominantly Republican state, and there wasn't much motivation for candidates to debate. This brought competing media like the Deseret News and the other papers in town, as well as the TV stations, as well as academics from Brigham Young University and the University of Utah and the other universities in the state, all together to promote debates. That was successful. We had five debates, and then at a reception following all those debates, Richard Davis, Professor Magleby, who was both at BYU, said, "Hey, maybe we should try to bring a debate to Utah." And that launched it. People got behind it immediately and began working for it.
And you were talking about collaboration earlier. It seems like Utah has collaboration down to a science when it comes to hosting major events like this.
Well, there's no question. In 2002, of course, Salt Lake City hosted the Winter Olympics. And that was a monumental effort, of course. That takes millions of dollars. It takes a bid process. Basically, every mover and shaker got involved with that. And there was 40,000 people volunteered. And Utah is a religious culture. They're used to serving, helping the homeless, helping those who need help, providing housing. And it's a natural extension from the Olympics and other major events to be able to very quickly marshal resources to host a presidential debate, and in this case, the vice presidential debate.
And speaking of resources, it costs a lot of money to host an event like this. What made Utah prepared to host the VP debate?
So a couple things. One, there's very much philanthropy alive and well in Salt Lake City. People support the arts. They support local government. And they're able to donate. Again, I mentioned the homeless. There's a lot of money that goes into the homeless. The legislature got behind it. They said that $2.5 million could be dedicated. And then the rest, which is millions, it's between $3 and $5 million to host, could be marshaled quickly. And that's what impressed the debate commission, the presidential commission on debates, that they knew we had the volunteer resources, we knew we had the venues, they knew that we had done it before, and it had the backing of not just government, but also the civilian workforce. So everything came together to go very quickly into that space.
And in the age of COVID-19, this is an unprecedented type of debate. What's going to make the vice presidential debate in Salt Lake City interesting?
Yeah, originally it was going to be in a major hall, and you'd have media from all around the world. Now there'll be about 200 media here. Every media member has to be tested. In fact, that testing is going on today. We have a couple of reporters who went up and tested, and some others who are going up who will be up there to be tested. Once tested, then they will go into it. There'll be about 400 people total in the hall, and then a huge press tent where people can be there who are not in the hall. And somewhere like the 60, 70 University of Utah students will be able to attend. So there was a drawing today, and if the students are, their name is drawn, they get both a ticket and a COVID-19 test. So it's a unique situation, to say the least.
So it's just going to be students and media as in part in this hall?
Well, there'll be families, some students, very limited media. Most of the media is in a media tent, and then a few other invited guests. But even the president of the university, other folks, myself as editor of the Deseret News, originally I would be up there, but now I'll be participating virtually. So it's everything's being done to protect everyone, particularly given what's happened in the White House and with the Trump administration, with President Trump. Expected to come home from the hospital today, but still suffering the effects of COVID-19.
And so where does the Utah Debate Commission go from here? Or should we wait until we see the outcome of tomorrow's debate?
Well, there's, this was, we worked in conjunction with the, because I'm a part of that commission, we worked in conjunction with the national team, and this just further gets Utahns involved. I mean, our whole goal is to have Utahns vote. We want people to vote. We want them to be engaged. And we will continue our work locally. And not clear whether we would be able to host another presidential debate because they move those around a bit. But hopefully it will go well and represent the state of Utah well and serve the country well. People are going to watch this debate. People are very interested in these two candidates.
Doug Wilkes is the editor of the Deseret News in Salt Lake City. Find his article Inside the Newsroom, What It Took to Bring the Vice Presidential Debate to Salt Lake City on Deseret.com. Doug Wilkes, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Nkoyo. Great to talk to you.
This is Washington Today. I'm your host, Nkoyo Iyamba. In other news, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin spoke for about an hour Monday, but emerged from a phone call with no coronavirus stimulus deal. The pair expects to talk again Tuesday as the White House and Democratic leaders try to craft an elusive fifth pandemic relief package. That's according to Speaker Pelosi's spokesman, Drew Hamill. He said in a tweet, Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin plan to exchange more details about their proposals Monday, he added. The tweet reads as follows, quote, Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin spoke by phone today at 11:30 a.m. for approximately 1 hour. The two discussed the justifications for various numbers and plan to exchange paper today in preparation for another phone call tomorrow. Now, the sides have made a final push in recent days to strike an aid agreement and pass legislation before the November 3rd election. While Speaker Pelosi and Secretary Mnuchin seem to have made progress toward a deal, they had a range of outstanding disagreements heading into today. A fourth wave of coronavirus infections soon could hit Hong Kong, the city's health experts have warned. The Asian financial hub had impressive success in tackling the disease with just over 1,400 infections and 7 deaths by the end of June. But it was hit that with that officials, it comes as officials Monday have reported 11 infections, including 4 local transmissions, bringing the total of COVID-19 cases to 5,125. The death toll also rose to 105 as of Monday, with elderly people accounting for the most of the dead. The South China Press calls this a third wave from early July, with the infection tally rising nearly fivefold and the death toll surpassing 100 within 3 months. And the parent of Regal Cinemas will temporarily shutter its more than 500 U.S. theaters Thursday, as well as its 127 Cineworld and Picture House locations in the U.K. The news comes after many movie theaters remain closed due to COVID-19 measures and the decision to push back the release of the latest James Bond film to April of 2021. Now here at home in Washington, D.C., the Supreme Court began its new term today with a tribute to the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Here's Chief Justice John Roberts with these opening remarks.
I have the honor to announce on behalf of the court that the October 2019 term of the Supreme Court of the United States is now closed, and the October 2020 term is now convened. Today's orders of the court have been duly entered and certified and filed with the clerk. I note that memorial drapery has been erected on the door of our courtroom and on the bench to signify mourning for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died on September 18, 2020. Justice Ginsburg was born in Brooklyn, New York, March 15, 1933. She received her BA from Cornell University and married Martin D. Ginsburg shortly after graduation. They briefly lived in Oklahoma, where Marty was stationed when called to active duty in the Army. They both pursued a career in law. She attended Harvard Law School and received her LLB from Columbia Law School in 1959, first in her class. Justice Ginsburg served as a law clerk to the Honorable Edmund L. Palmieri, Judge of the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, from 1959 to 1961. From 1961 to 1963, she was a research associate and then associate director of the Columbia Law School Project on International Procedure. Justice Ginsburg was a professor of law at Rutgers University School of Law from 1963 to 1972 and Columbia Law School from 1972 to 1980. In 1971, she was instrumental in launching the Women's Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union. She argued six significant gender discrimination cases in this court, winning five. President Carter appointed Justice Ginsburg to the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and she served there as a circuit judge from 1980 to 1993. President Clinton appointed her to this court in 1993. She was the second woman appointed to the court and served more than 27 years. During her time on the court, she authored 483 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions. Justice Ginsburg's contributions as advocate, jurist, and citizen are immeasurable. We at the court will remember her as a dear friend and a treasured colleague. Justice Ginsburg is survived by her two children, Jane Carol Ginsburg and James Stephen Ginsburg, four grandchildren, two step-grandchildren, and one great-grandchild. We extend our condolences to her children, extended family, and countless admirers. At an appropriate time, the traditional memorial service of the court and bar will be held in our courtroom.
That was Chief Justice John Roberts earlier today. The future of the Affordable Care Act and a sweep of religious freedom are among the high-profile issues coming before the Supreme Court this term. The court could also play a role in possible disputes over the presidential election before the year is over. The justices will hear arguments virtually due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Campaign 2020 here on C-SPAN Radio. Republican Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey is leaving politics. He made the announcement earlier this afternoon in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania.
Good morning, and thanks for being here. Special thanks to my family for joining me today. My wife, Chris, my son, Patrick, on the far left, my daughter, Bridget, and our son, Duncan. My family and I have reached a decision, and I wanted to share that with the people of Pennsylvania, and that is that I will not be running for re-election in 2022, and I will not be running for governor. I will serve out the remainder of my term for a little over 2 years that are left to the current term, and after that, my plan is to go back to the private sector. I want to say very clearly that representing the people of Pennsylvania, this big, beautiful, complicated, diverse state, has been an extraordinary, amazing honor. It still is. And it's been by far the highlight of my professional life. The reasons that I've reached this decision are not political. They're personal. The decision is consistent with the long-held view I've had in support of term limits. I committed myself to limiting my terms in the House. I didn't do that in the Senate, but I always thought that I'd probably serve just two terms, and often mentioned that along the way. But the real reasons are, by the time I finish this term, I will have been in public office for 18 years. Over a 24-year period, there was a six-year hiatus, but even then, I was very involved in government and politics, running the Club for Growth, and spending two of those years running for the Senate. 18 years is a long time. And, you know, all of that time, our family has lived in Pennsylvania. That was the right decision for our family. And I've spent as little time as I can in Washington, coming back home as quickly as I can after the end of official business. But it still ends up being a lot of time. A lot of time away from home, and I'm looking forward to more time back at home. I have no specific plans, and I'm not going to spend time or energy thinking about what I'll do later until a good 2 years from now, because I've got a lot of work still ahead of me.
In addition to his public service, Senator Pat Toomey has worked in the financial services industry and, as you just heard, served as president of the Club for Growth and owned and operated a small restaurant chain in the Lehigh Valley with his brothers. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is campaigning in Florida today. The former vice president visited historic Little Haiti and Little Havana ahead of an NBC town hall event near downtown Miami tonight. Here's a portion of Joe Biden's remarks.
And I want to thank Victoria. Victoria, for sharing her family's journey with us today. Victoria and I were talking a little bit earlier. I was in South Asia speaking with a president, and he asked me what made America unique, and I said immigration, because it's the history of this country. And he looked at me funny. He said, why is that? And I said, because almost everybody who's come here, other than those who came in chains 400 years ago beginning, came because they were escaping something, and it took enormous courage. I really mean this. Think about it. Enormous courage to leave everything they knew, everything that was familiar, sometimes leaving family members, to get in a boat, a plane, train, whatever the means was, to be able to leave and start a new life. And to do that, you have to have optimism, courage. You have to be resilient. You have to be willing to believe you can make things change for the better. That's what's built this country, immigration.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden campaigning in Florida today. David Smiley is the senior political reporter for the Miami Herald, and he's following the Biden campaign. David, what's significant about this visit to historic Little Haiti and Little Havana?
Miami is home to the largest community of Haitian Americans off the island in the country. And it's important for Biden to perform well, to connect with Haitian American voters who make up a very significant part of Miami's larger Black community. And Biden's campaign offended a number of Haitian Americans last month when his running mate Kamala Harris came to Miami and held a Black leaders roundtable. And there were no Haitian Americans on that roundtable. And there were activists who felt somewhat offended and others who felt like it was indicative of a lackadaisical approach to trying to reach Creole-speaking Haitian Americans and connect with them before the election, many feeling like the Biden campaign was taking them for granted. So this is clearly a step to showing the Haitian American community that they matter to the Democrats, they matter to Joe Biden, and they're going to try to bridge that gap today. Afterward, to Little Havana, which is also the historical exile home of Cuban Americans, the place where many Cuban American exiles settled and established themselves when Fidel Castro took over in Cuba. What's interesting there is, you know, one, we know that Biden needs to do better with Cuban American voters. And so on one hand, his visit today is also a sign of him reaching out to try to boost his numbers with that very large community. Cuban Americans make up about maybe half of the Hispanic population in Miami-Dade County, and we have about 900,000 Hispanic voters in Miami-Dade County. However, Little Havana is also heavily becoming a Central American community. A number of Haitian Americans have left Little Haiti and moved to sort of, I guess, what we would loosely call Miami suburbs. A lot of Cuban Americans have left Little Havana and gone west or gone east or north. And there, the neighborhood is increasingly becoming very blue collar, a lot of Nicaraguans, a lot of Central Americans living there. So it's not only an attempt to reach Cuban American voters by the Biden campaign, but also what we would largely describe in politics as the non-Cuban Hispanic vote, which for Biden is very important. He's going to lose conservative Cuban American voters, but he should win with non-Cubans, and his campaign feels like he should do very well with them, and they probably feel like he needs to do better.
And to that end, what's the message that he has for these different communities?
So largely, the Biden campaign is focusing on coronavirus and on the economy. So he's coming in and talking up his Build Back Better message, although today they've rebranded it En Español, to connect with the voters that they're meeting with. But he's going in today to talk about trying to set the country, in his words, back on the right course to get the coronavirus pandemic under control. Miami has been one of the worst hard-hit metros from the pandemic in the country. And so Biden is going to address that. But he's also talking about health care, about trying to improve upon Obamacare. Miami is also, the metro area is also the capital for Obamacare in the country. So that's an important message in that community. And then also talking about the economy, there are a lot of people in Miami's tourism-driven economy who are really suffering right now during the pandemic. And so he's also bringing an economic message about jobs and labor.
What's significant about tonight's town hall event? This is with undecided voters, isn't it?
Correct. Tonight's town hall forum with Joe Biden, it's an NBC event. It's at the Perez Art Museum Miami, which is this fairly swanky art museum built on the bay, overlooking a lot of very beautiful sites in Miami. So it's a very nice place to do it. I guess they're going to do it outside. So we don't know exactly what he'll be asked, but it is, I think, for Biden, a setting his campaign wants to put him in, where he can be on TV talking to voters directly and engaging with people, and where they feel like he does very well and comes off as empathetic and personable when he's talking to people, as opposed to, say, you know, trying to wrangle with Donald Trump on the debate stage.
And Jill Biden, she also has a big role to play here in parts of Florida. What are her plans?
Right. Jill Biden will be with her husband in Miami today, but before the town hall, she's going to head up to Palm Beach County to Boca Raton to do a drive-in rally. So the Biden campaign has really tried to adopt a grassroots strategy that Trump supporters in Miami began doing a long time ago, with car caravans going all throughout Miami. The Trump campaign has really had some very massive turnout for these events, which have kept traffic going in Miami, even when the pandemic slowed things down. So the Biden campaign has really started trying to adopt those models. It's a socially distanced way to show your enthusiasm. And so she's going to be out with supporters in their cars today in Boca Raton.
David Smiley is a senior political reporter for the Miami Herald. Find his article on the Biden campaign at miamiherald.com. David, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
That's it for today's Washington Today. Remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can find it as a podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search Washington Today or go to our website, cspan.org/podcast. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your evening.